From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Witch's Cap by Gans T. Field. Old Jael Bettis, who lived in the hollow among the cypresses, was not a real witch. It makes no difference that folks thought she was and walked fearfully wide of her shadow. Nothing can be proved by the fact that she was as disgustingly ugly without as she was wicked within. It is quite irrelevant that evil was her study and profession and pleasure. She was no witch, she only pretended to be. Jael Bettis knew that all laws providing for the punishment of witches had been repealed, or at the least forgotten. As to being feared and hated, that was meat and drink to Jael Bettis, living secretly alone in the hollow. The house and the hollow belonged to a kindly old villager who had been elected marshal and was too busy to look after his property. Because he was easygoing and perhaps a little daunted, he let Jael Bettis live there rent-free. The house was no longer snug. The back of its roof was broken in, the eaves drooped slackly. At some time or other, the place had been painted brown, before that with ivory black. Now both coats of color peeled away in huge flakes, making the clapboard seem scrofulous. The windows had been broken in every small grubby pane and mended with coarse brown paper, so that they were like cast and blurred eyes. Behind was the muddy bramble-choked backyard, and behind that yawned the old quarry, now abandoned and full of black water. As for the inside, but few ever saw it. Jael Bettis did not like people to come into her house. She always met callers on the old cracked doorstep, draped in a cloak of shadowy black, with gray hair straggling her nose, as hooked and sharp as the beak of a buzzard. Her eyes filmy and sore-looking, her wrinkled, bordered mouth always grinning and showing her yellow, chisel-shaped teeth. The nearby village was an old-fashioned place with stone flags instead of concrete for pavements, and the villagers were the simplest of men and women. From them, Jael Bettis made a fair living by selling love philters or herbs to cure sickness or charms to ward off bad luck. When she wanted extra money, she would wrap her old black cloak about her, and tramping along a country road, would stop at a cow pen and ask the farmer what he would do if his cows went dry. The farmer, worried usually, came at dawn next day to her hollow and bought a good luck charm. Occasionally the cows would go dry anyway, by accident of nature, and their owner would pay more and more until their milk returned to them. Now and then, when Jael Bettis came to the door, there came with her the gaunt black cat Gib. Gib was not truly black, any more than Jael Bettis was truly a witch. He had been born with white markings at muzzle, chest, and forepaws, so that he looked to be in full evening dress. Left alone, he would have grown fat and fluffy, but Jael Bettis, who wanted a fearsome pet, kept all his white spots smeared with thick suet and underfed him to make him look rakish and lean. On the night of the full moon, she would drive poor Gib from her door. He would wander to the village in search of food and would wail mournfully in the yards. Awakened householders would angrily throw boots or pans or sticks of kindling. Often Gib was hit and his cries were sharpened by pain. When that happened, Jael Bettis took care to be seen next morning with a bandage on head or wrist. Some of the simplest villagers thought that Gib was really the old woman, magically transformed. Her reputation grew, as did Gib's unpopularity. But Gib did not deserve mistrust. Like all cats, he was a practical philosopher who wanted to be comfortable and quiet and dignified. At bottom, he was amiable. Like all cats, too, he loved his home above all else, and the house in the hollow be it ever so humble and often cruel, was home. It was unthinkable to him that he might live elsewhere. In the village, he had two friends, black-eyed John Frey, the storekeeper's son, who brought the mail to and from the county seat, and Ivy Hill, pretty blonde daughter of the town marshal, the same town marshal who owned the hollow and let Jael Bettis live in the old house. John Frey and Ivy Hill were so much in love with each other that they loved everything else, even black-stained, hungry Gib. He was grateful. If he had been able, he would have loved them in return, but his little heart had room for one devotion only, and that was given to the house in the hollow. One day, Jael Bettis slouched darkly into old Mr. Frey's store and up to the counter that served for post office. Leering, she gave John Frey a letter. It was directed to a certain little-known publisher, asking for a certain little-known book. Several days later, she appeared again, received a parcel, and bore it to her home. In her gloomy, secret parlor, she unwrapped her purchase. It was a small, drab volume with no title on cover or back. Sitting at the rickety table, she began to read. All evening and most of the night, she read, forgetting to give Gib his supper, though he sat hungrily at her feet. At length, an hour before dawn, she finished, laughing loudly and briefly. She turned her beak nose towards the kerosene lamp on the table. From the book, she read aloud two words. The lamp went out. Though she had not blown at it, Jael Bettis spoke one commanding word more, and the lamp flamed alight again. At last, she cried out in shrill exultation and grinned down at Gib. Her lips drew back from her yellow chisels of teeth. At last, she crowed again. Why don't you speak to me, little brute? Why don't you indeed? She asked that final question as though she had been suddenly inspired. Quickly, she glanced through the back part of the book, howled with laughter over something she found there, then sprang up and scuttled like a big, filthy crab into the dark, windowless cell that was her kitchen. There she mingled salt and malt in the palm of her skinny right hand. After that, she rummaged out a bundle of dried herbs, chewed them fine, and spat them into the mixture. Stirring again with her forefinger, she returned to the parlor. Scanning the book to refresh her memory, she muttered a nasty little rhyme. Finally, she dashed the mess suddenly upon Gib. He retreated, shaking himself, outraged and startled. In a corner, he sat down and bent his head to lick the smeared fragments of the mixture away, but they revolted his tongue and palate, and he paused in the midst of his chore, so important to Kantz, and meanwhile Jael Bettis yelled, "Speak!" Gib crouched and blinked, feeling sick. His tongue came out and steadied his lips, finally said, "I want something to eat." His voice was small and high, like a little child's, but entirely understandable. Jael Bettis was so delighted that she laughed and clapped her bony knees with her hands in self-applause. "It worked," she cried. "No more humbug about me, you understand? I'm a real witch at last, and not a fraud." Gib found himself able to understand all this more clearly than he had ever understood human affairs before. "I want something to eat," he said again, more definitely than before. "I didn't have any supper, and it's nearly..."
"Oh, stow your gab," snapped his mistress. "This book, crammed with knowledge and strength that made me able to do it, I'll never be without it again. And it'll teach me all the things I've only guessed at and mumbled about. I'm a real witch now, I say. If you don't think I'll make those ignorant sheep of villagers realize it..." Once more, she went off into gales of laughter and drew a dish at Gib. He darted away into a corner just in time, and the missile crashed into blue and white china fragments against the wall. But Jael Bettis read aloud from her book an impressive gibberish, and the dish reformed itself on the floor. The bits crept together and joined, and the cracks disappeared as trickling drops of water formed into a pool. And finally, when the witch's twig-like forefinger beckoned, the dish floated upward like a leaf in a breeze and set itself gently back on the table. Gib watched warily. "That's small to what I shall do hereafter," swore Jael Bettis. When next the mail was distributed at the general store, a dazzling stranger appeared. She wore a cloak and old-fashioned black coat, but his drapery did not conceal the tall perfection of her form. As for her face, it would have stirred interest and admiration in larger, more sophisticated gatherings than the knot of letter-seeking villagers. Its beauty was scornful but inviting, classic but warm, with something in it of Grecian sculpture and Oriental allure. If the nose was cool, it was straight. If the lips were sullen, they were full. If the forehead was a suspicion low, it was white and smooth. Thick, thunder-black hair swept up from that forehead and backward to a knot at the neck. The eyes glowed with strange hot lights, and wherever they turned, they pierced and captivated. People moved away to let her have a clear, sweeping pathway forward to the counter. Until the stranger had entered, Ivy Hill was the loveliest person present. Now she looked only modest and fresh and blonde in her starched gingham and worried to boot. As a matter of fact, Ivy Hill's insides felt cold and topsy-turvy because she saw how fascinated was the sudden attention of John Frey. "Is there," asked the newcomer in a deep, creamy voice, "any mail for me?" "What name, ma'am?" asked John Frey, his brown young cheeks turning full crimson. "Bettis, Jael Bettis." He began to fumble through the sheaf of envelopes with hands that shook. "Are you," he asked, "any relation to the old lady of that name? The one who lives in the hollow?" "Yes, of a sort," she smiled, a slow conquering smile. "She's my aunt. Yes, perhaps you see the family resemblance." Wider and wider grew the smile with which she assaulted John Frey. "If there isn't any mail," she went on, "I would like a stamp, a 1-cent stamp." Turning to his little metal box on the shelf behind, John Frey tore a single green stamp from the sheet. His hand shook still more as he gave it to the customer and received in exchange a copper cent. There was really nothing exceptional about the appearance of that copper cent. It looked brown and a little worn, with Lincoln's head on it and a date, 1917. But John Frey felt a sudden glow in the hand that took it, a glow that shot along his arm and into his heart. He gazed at the coin as if he had never seen its like before, and he put it slowly into his pocket, a different pocket from the one in which he usually kept change, and placed another coin in the till to pay for the stamp. Poor Ivy Hill's blue eyes grew round and downright miserable. Plainly he meant to keep that copper piece as a souvenir. But John Frey gazed only at the stranger raptly, as though he were suddenly stunned or hypnotized. The dark, sullen beauty drew her cloak more tightly around her and moved regally out of the store and away toward the edge of town. As she turned up the brush-hidden trail to the hollow, a change came. Not that her step was less young and free, her figure less queenly, her eyes dimmer, or her beauty short of perfect. All these were as they had been, and her expression became set and grim, her body tense and her head high and truculent. It was as though beneath that young loveliness lurked an old and evil heart, which was precisely what did lurk there. It does not boot to conceal. But none saw except Gib, the black cat with soot-covered white spots, who sat on the doorstep of the ugly cottage. Jael Bettis thrust him aside with her foot and entered. In the kitchen, she filled a tin basin from a wooden bucket and threw it into the water, a pinch of coarse green powder with an unpleasant smell. As she stirred it in with her hands, they seemed to grow skinny and harsh. Then she threw great palmfuls of the liquid into her face and over her head, and other changes came. The woman who returned to the front door, where Gib watched with a cat's apprehensive interest, was hideous old Jael Bettis, whom all the village knew and avoided. "He's trapped," she shrilled triumphantly. "That penny, the one I soaked for 3 hours in a love filter, trapped him the moment he touched it." She stumped the table and patted the book as though it were a living, lovable thing. "You taught me," she crooned to it. "You're winning me the love of John Frey." She paused, and her voice grew harsh again. "Why not? I'm old and ugly and queer, but I can love, and John Frey is the handsomest man in the village." The next day, she went to the store again in her new and dazzling person as a dark, beautiful girl. Gib, left alone in the hollow, turned over in his mind the things that he had heard. The new gift of human speech had brought with it, of necessity, a human quality of reasoning, but his viewpoint and his logic were as strongly feline as ever. Jael Bettis' dark love that lured Jonfrey promised no good to Gib. There would be plenty of trouble, he was inclined to think, and trouble was something that all sensible cats avoided. He was wise now, but he was weak. What could he do against danger? And his desires, as they had been since kittenhood, were food and warmth and a cozy sleeping place and a little respectful affection. Just now he was getting none of the four. He thought also of Ivy Hill. She liked him, and often had shown it. If she won Jonfrey, despite the witch's plan, the two would build a house all full of creature comforts. Cushions, open fires, probably fish and chopped liver. Gib's tongue caressed his soot-stained lips at the savory thought. It would be good to have a home with Ivy Hill and Jonfrey, if once he was quit of Jael Bettis. But he put the thought from him. The witch had never held his love and loyalty. That went to the house in the hollow, his home since the month that he was born. Even magic had not taught him how to be rid of that cat instinctive obsession for his own proper dwelling place. The sinister strife-sodden hovel would always call and claim him, would draw him back from the warmest fire, the softest bed, the most savory food in the world. Only John Howard Payne could have appreciated Gibbs' yearnings to the full, and he died long ago, an exile from the home he loved. When Jael Bettis returned, she was in a fine, trembling rage. Her real self shone through the glamour of her disguise like murky fire through a thin porcelain screen. Gib was on the doorstep again and tried to dodge away as she came up, but her enchantments or something else had made Jael Bettis too quick even for a cat. She darted out a hand and caught him by the scruff of the neck. "Listen to me," she said in a voice as deadly as a trickle of poisoned water. "You understand human words. You can talk, and you can hear what I say. You can do what I say, too." She shook him by way of emphasis. "Can't you do what I say?"
"Yes," said Gib, weakly convulsed with fear.
"All right. I have a job for you. And mind you do it well, or else." She broke off and shook him again, letting him imagine what would happen if he disobeyed.
"Yes," said Gib again, panting for breath in her tight grip. "What's it about?"
"It's about that little fool, Ivy Hill. She's not quite out of his heart." "Go to the village tonight," ordered Jael Bettis, "and to the house of the marshal. Steal something that belongs to Ivy Hill."
"Steal something?
Don't echo me, as if you were a silly parrot." She let go of him and hurried back to the book that was her constant study. "Bring me something that Ivy Hill owns and touches, and be back here with it before dawn." Gib carried out her orders. Shortly after sundown, he crept through the deepened dusk to the home of Marshall Hill. Doubly black with a suit habitually smeared upon him by Jael Bettis, he would have been almost invisible, even had anyone been on guard against his coming. But nobody watched. The genial old man sat on the front steps talking to his daughter. "Say," the father teased, "isn't young Johnny Frey coming over here tonight as usual?"
"I don't know, Daddy," said Ivy Hill wretchedly.
"What's that, daughter?" The marshal sounded surprised. "Is there anything gone wrong between you two young'uns?"
"Perhaps not, but..." "Oh, Daddy, there's a new girl come to town."
And Ivy Hill burst into tears, groping dolefully on the step beside her for her little wadded handkerchief. But she could not find it. For Gib, stealing near, caught it up in his mouth. I was scampering away toward the edge of town and beyond to the house in the hollow. Meanwhile, Jael Bettis worked hard at a certain project of wax modeling. Any witch or student of witchcraft would have known at once why she did this. After several tries, she achieved something quite interesting and even clever, a little female figure that actually resembled Ivy Hill. Jael Bettis used the wax of 3 candles to give it enough substance and proportion. To make it more realistic, she got some fresh, pale gold hemp, and of this made hair like the wig of a blonde doll for the wax head. Drops of blue ink served her eyes and a blob of berry juice for the red mouth. All the while she worked, Jael Bettis was muttering and mumbling words and phrases she had gleaned from the rearward pages of her book. When Gib brought in the handkerchief, Jael Bettis snatched it from his mouth with a grunt by way of thanks. With rusty scissors and coarse white thread, she fashioned for the wax figure a little dress. It happened that the handkerchief was of gingham, so the garment made all the more striking the puppet's resemblance to Ivy Hill. "You're a fine one," tittered the witch, propping her finished figure against the lamp. "You'd better be scared," for it happened that she had worked into the wax and faced an expression of terror. The blue ink of the eyes made wide, round blotches, a state of agonized fear, and the berry juice mouth seemed to tremble, to plead shakily for mercy. Again, Jael Bettis refreshed her memory of goetic spells by poring over the back of the book, and after that she dug from the bottom of an old pasteboard box a handful of rusty pins. She chuckled over them so that one would think triumph already hers. Laying the puppet on its side so that the lamplight fell full upon it, she began to recite a spell. "I have made my wish before," she said in measured tones. "I will make it now, and there was never a day that I did not see my wish fulfilled." Simple, vague, but how many have died because those words were spoken in a certain way over images of them? The witch thrust a pin into the breast of the little wax figure and drove it all the way in, with a murderous pressure of her thumb. Another pin she pushed into the head, another into an arm, another into a leg, and so on until the gingham-clad puppet was fairly studded with transfixing pins. "Now," she said, "we shall see what we shall see." Morning dawned, as clear and golden as though wickedness had never been born into the world. The mysterious new paragon of beauty, not a young man of the village, but mooned over her, even though she was a reputed niece and namesake of the unsavory old vagabond, Jael Bettis, walked into the general store to make purchases. One delicate pink ear turned to the gossip of the housewives. "Wasn't it awful?" they were agreeing. "How poor little Ivy Hill was suddenly sick, almost to death. She didn't seem to know her father or her friends, not even Dr. Melcher, could find out what was the matter with her. Strange that John Frey was not interested in her troubles, but John Frey sat behind the counter, slumped on a stool like a mud idol, and his eyes lighted up only when they spied lovely young Jael Bettis with her market basket." When she had heard enough, the witch left the store and went straight to the town marshal's house. There she spoke gravely and sorrowfully about how she feared for the sick girl and was allowed to visit Ivy in her bedroom. To the father and the doctor, it seemed that the patient grew stronger and felt less pain, while Jael Bettis remained to wish her a quick recovery. But not long after this new acquaintance departed, Ivy Hill grew worse. She fainted and recovered only to vomit. And she vomited pins, rusty pins, something like that happened in Old Salem Village, and earlier still, in Scotland, before the grisly cult of North Berwick was literally burned out. The Dr. Melcher, a more modern scholar, had never seen or heard of anything remotely resembling Ivy Hill's disorder. So it went for 3 full days. Gib, too, heard the doleful gossip as he slunk around the village to hunt for food and to avoid Jael Bettis, who did not like him near when she did magic. Ivy Hill was dying, and he mourned her. As for the boon of fish and fire and cushions and petting that might have been his, he knew, too, that he was responsible for her doom and his loss. That handkerchief that he had stolen had helped Jael Bettis to direct her spells. But philosophy came again to his aid. If Ivy Hill died, she died. Anyway, he had never been given the chance to live as her pensioner and pet. He was not even sure that he would have taken the chance. Thinking of it, he felt strong, accustomed clamps upon his heart. The house in the hollow was his home forever. Elsewhere, he'd be an exile. Nothing would ever root it out of his feline soul. On the evening of the third day, Witch and Cat faced each other across the tabletop in the old house in the hollow. "They've talked loud enough to make his dull ears hear," grumbled the fearful old woman, with none but Gib to see her. She had washed away the disguising enchantment that, though so full of lure, seemed to be a burden upon her. "John Frey has agreed to take Ivy Hill out in his automobile. The doctor thinks that the fresh air and John Frey's company will make her feel better, but it won't. It's too late. She'll never return from that drive. She took up the pin-pierced waxed image of her rival. Rose started towards the kitchen.
What are you going to do?
Gibb forced himself to ask.
Do?
Repeated Jill Bettis, smiling murderously. I'm going to put an end to that baby-faced chit. But why are you so curious? Get out! You're prying. And snarling curses and striking with her claw-like hands, she made him spring down from his chair and run out of the house. The door slammed, and he crouched in some brambles and watched. No sound, and at the half-blinded window, no movement. But after a time, smoke began to coil upward from the chimney. Its first puffs were dark and greasy-looking. Then it turned dull gray, then white, then blue as indigo. Finally, it vanished altogether. When Jill Bettis opened the door and came out, she was once more in the semblance of a beautiful dark girl, yet Gibb recognized a greater terror about her than ever before. "You be gone from here when I get back," she said to him.
"Gone?"
stammered Gibb, his little heart turning cold.
"What do you mean?"
She stooped above him like a threatening bird of prey. "You be gone," she repeated. "If I ever see you again, I'll kill you, or I'll make my new husband kill you." He still could not believe her. He shrank back and his eyes turned mournfully to the old house that was the only thing he loved. "You're the only witness to the things I've done," Jill Bettis continued. "Nobody would believe their ears if a cat started telling tales. But anyway, I don't want any trace of you around. If you leave, they'll forget that I used to be a witch. So run!" She turned away. Her mutterings were now only her thoughts aloud. "If my magic words, and it always works, that car will find itself idling around through the hill road to the other side of the quarry. John Frey will stop there, and so will Ivy Hill forever." Drawing her cloak around her, she stalked purposefully towards the old quarry behind the house. Left by himself, Gibb lowered his lids and let his yellow eyes grow dim and deep with thought. His shrewd beast blind pawed and probed at this final wonder and danger that faced him in John Frey and Ivy Hill. He must run away if he would live. The witch's house in the hollow that had never welcomed him now threatened him. No more basking on the doorstep, no more ambushing wood mice among the brambles, no more dozing by the kitchen fire. Nothing for Gibb henceforth but strange, forbidding wilderness and scavenger's food, and no shelter, not on the coldest night. The village, but his only two friends, John Frey and Ivy Hill, were being taken from him by the magic of Jill Bettis and her book. That book had done this. That book must undo it. There was no time to lose. The door was not quite latched, and he nosed it open, despite the groans of its hinges. Hurrying in, he sprang up on the table. It was gloomy in that tree-invested house, even for Gibb's sharp eyes. Therefore, in a trembling fear, almost too big for his little body, he spoke a word that Jill Bettis had spoken on her first night of power. As had happened then, so it happened now. The dark lamp glowed a light. Gibb pawed at the closed book and contrived to lift its cover. Pressing it open with one front foot, with the other he painstakingly turned leaves, and more yet. Finally came to the page he wanted. Not that he could read, and in any case, the characters were strange in their shapes and combinations. Yet if one looked long enough and levelly enough, even though one were a cat and afraid, they made sense, conveyed intelligence. And so into the mind of Gibb, beat out his fears, there stole a phrase, "Beware of mirrors." So that was why Jill Bettis never kept a mirror, not even now when she could assume such dazzling beauty. "Beware of mirrors," the book said to Gibb, "for they declare the truth, and truth is fatal to sorcery. Beware also of crosses, which defeat all spells." That was definite inspiration. He moved back from the book and let it snap shut. Then, pushing with head and paws, he coaxed it to the edge of the table and let it fall. Jumping down after, he caught a corner of the book in his teeth and dragged it to the door, more like a retriever than a cat. When he got into the yard, into a place where the earth was soft, he dug furiously until he had made a big hole, enough to contain the volume. Then, thrusting it in, he covered it up.
Nor was that all his effort, so far as the book was concerned. He trotted a little away, off to where lay some dry, tough twigs under the cypress trees. To the little grave he bore first one, then another of these, and laid them across each other in the form of an X. He pressed them well into the earth so that they would be hard to disturb. Perhaps he would keep an eye on that spot henceforth, after he had done the rest of the thing in his mind, to see that the cross remained. And though he acted thus only by chance reasoning, all the demonologists, even the Reverend Montague Summers, would have nodded approval. Is this not the way to foil the black wisdom of the Grand Albert? Did not Prospero thus enter his remorse in the fifth act of Tempest? Now back to the house once more and into the kitchen. It was even darker than the parlor, but Gibb could make out a basin on a stool by the moldy wall and smelled an ugly pungency. Jael Bettis had left her mixture of powdered water after last washing away her burden of false beauty. Gibb's feline nature rebelled at a wedding, his experience of witchcraft bade him be wary, but he rose on his hind legs and with his forepaws dragged at the basin's edge. It tipped and toppled. The noisome fluid drenched him. Wheeling, he ran back into the parlor, but paused on the doorstep. He spoke two more words that he remembered from Jael Bettis. The lamp went out again. And now he dashed around the house and through the brambles and to the quarry beyond. It lay amid uninhabited wooded hills, a wide excavation from which had once been quarried all the stones for the village houses and pavements. Now it was full of water from many thaws and torrents. Almost at a slip was parked John Frey's touring car, with the top down, and beside it he lolled, slack-faced and dreamy. At his side, cloak-draped and enigmatically queenly, was Jael Bettis, her back to the quarry, never more terrible or handsome. John Frey's eyes were fixed dreamily upon her, and her eyes were fixed commandingly on the figure in the front seat of the car. A slumped, defeated figure, hard to recognize as poor sick Ivy Hill. Can you think of no way to end all this pain, Miss Ivy? The witch was asking. Though she did not stir nor glance behind her, it was as though she had gestured toward the great quarry pit, full to unknown depths with black, still water. The sun at the very point of setting made angry red lights on the surface of that stagnant pond. "Go away," sobbed Ivy Hill, afraid without knowing why. "Please, please." "I'm only trying to help," said Jael Bettis. "Isn't that so, John?" "That's so, Ivy," agreed John, like a little boy who's prompted to an unfamiliar recitation. "She's only trying to help." Gibb, moving silently as fate, crept to the back of the car. None of the three human beings, so intent upon each other, saw him. "Get out of the car," persisted Jael Bettis. "Get out and look into the water. You will forget your pain." "Yes, yes," chimed in John Frey mechanically. "You will forget your pain." Gibb scrambled stealthily to the running board, then over the side of the car and into the rear seat. He found what he had hoped to find, Ivy Hill's purse, and opened. He pushed his nose into it, tucked into a little side pocket, was a hard, flat rectangle, about the size and shape of his visiting card. All normal girls carry mirrors in their purses. All mirrors show the truth. Gibb clamped the edge with his mouth and struggled to drag the thing free. "Miss Ivy," Jael Bettis was commanding, "get out of this car and come and look into the water of the quarry." No doubt what would happen if once Ivy Hill should gaze into that shiny black abyss, but she bowed her head in agreement or defeat and began slowly to push aside the catch of the door. "Now or never," thought Gibb. He made a little noise in his throat and sprang up on the side of the car next to Jael Bettis. His black-stained face and yellow eyes were not a foot from her. She alone saw him. Ivy Hill was too sick, John Frey too dull. "What are you doing here?" she snarled, like a bigger and fiercer cat than he. But he moved closer still, holding up the oblong in his teeth.
Its back was uppermost, covered with imitation leather, and hid the real nature of it. Jael Bettis was mystified. For once in a relationship with Gibb, she took the thing from him, turned it over, and saw a reflection. She screamed. The other two looked up horrified through their stupor. The scream that Jael Bettis uttered was not deep and rich and young. It was the wild, cracked cry of a terrified old woman. "I don't look like that," she choked out and drew back from the car. "Not old, ugly." Gibbs sprang at her face. With all four claw bristling feet, he seized and clung to her. Again, Jael Bettis screamed, flung up her hands, and tore him away from his hold. But his soggy fur had smeared the powdered water upon her face and head. Though he fell to earth, Gibb twisted in midair and landed upright. He had one glimpse of his enemy. Jael Bettis. No mistake, but a Jael Bettis with hooked beak, roomy eyes, hideous wry mouth, and yellow chiseled teeth. Jael Bettis, exposed for what she was, stripped of her lying mask of beauty. And she drew back a whole staggering step. Rocks were just behind her. Gibbs saw and flung himself. Like a flash, he clawed his way up her cloak and with both forepaws ripped at the ugliness he had betrayed. He struck for his home that was forbidden him. Marco Brosaris never strove harder for Greece, nor Stonewall Jackson for Virginia. Jael Bettis screamed yet again, a scream loud and full of horror. Her feet had slipped on the edge of the abyss. She flung out her arms, the cloak flapped from them like frantic wings. She fell and Gibb fell with her, still tearing and fighting. The waters of the quarry closed over them both. Gibb thought that it was a long way back to the surface and a longer way to shore, but he got there and scrambled out with the help of protecting rocks. He shook his drenched body, climbed back into the car, and sat upon the rear seat. At least, Jael Bettis would no longer drive him from the home he loved. He'd find food some way and take it back there each day to eat. With tongue and paws, he began to rearrange his sodden fur. John Frey, clear-eyed and wide awake, was leaning in and talking to Ivy Hill. As for her, she sat up straight, as though she had never known a moment of sickness. "But just what did happen?" she was asking. John Frey shook his head, though all the stupidity was gone from his face and manner. "I don't quite remember. I seem to have wakened from a dream. But are you all right, darling?" "Yes, I'm all right." She gazed toward the quarry, the black water that had already subsided above what it had swallowed. Her eyes were puzzled, but not frightened. "I was dreaming, too," she said. "Let's not bother about it." She lifted her gaze and cried out with joy. "There's that old house that Daddy owns. Isn't it interesting?" John Frey looked too. "Yes, the old witch has gone away. I seem to have heard she did." Ivy Hill was smiling with excitement. "Then I have an inspiration. Let's get Daddy to give it to us. And we'll paint it over and fix it up, and then..." She broke off with a cry of delight. "I declare, there's a cat in the car with me." It was the first she had known of Gibb's presence. John Frey stared at Gibb. He seemed to have wakened only the moment before. "Yes, isn't he a thin one? But he'll be pretty when he gets through cleaning himself. I think I see a white shirt front." Ivy Hill put out a hand and scratched Gibb behind the ear. "He's bringing us good luck, I think. John, let's take him to live with us when we have the house fixed up and move in." "Why not?" asked her lover. He was gazing at Gibb. He looks as if he was getting ready to speak. But Gibb was not getting ready to speak. The power of speech was gone from him, along with Jael Bettis and her enchantments. But he understood, in a measure, what was being said about him and the house in the hollow. There would be new life there, joyful and friendly this time. And he would be a part of it forever, of his loved home. He could only purr to show his relief and gratitude.